It's Friday!
No, it isn't.
It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for this 10th day of December 2019. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us live on the interweb tubes. It's also where you find us when we're, you know, not live. Not as in not a live, but as in pre-recorded, because there's a podcast tab there that you can use for all of your podcasting needs. Makes it easy, easy, easy. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Titanic Tuesday. On the Horn. Oh, it is. It is. The 10th day of December 2019. And, it's full speed ahead. Right smack dab into that there iceberg. At least as far as, the maggots are concerned. The folks who think that Donald Trump shouldn't be impeached because he's done such a gall-danged fine job. Yeesh. Brother Deacon Asa letting us know, hot on both streams aboard what's left of the USS Trump-tanic. Oh, yeah. I don't think it's a USS. I think it's an SS. Not that kind of SS. You know what I mean. But, yeah. The Brother Deacon Asa wants everybody to know, if there's any question about when the program is beginning live, there is a great, giant, goddamn big, humongous red banner across the main page at HeadOn.live. It's not just at the main page, it's at every single page. If you go to HeadOn.live, you cannot miss the fact that the hours for the live program have changed. In fact, I got an email from, I got an internet. It's not a big truck, it's a series of tubes. That's never going to get old, is it? I got an internet from Ralphs up in Wisconsin saying, LOL, I'm here, Bob. I'm glad, and hopefully folks will begin to sort of notice the new time there. I had a note from Clarity last night saying, well, I knew about the time change, I just forgot about the time change. Not to worry, we don't give out detention or anything for being tardy. So, just remember, we are 5 to 8 Eastern, 4 to 7 Central, 3 to 6 Mountain, and 2 to 5 Pacific now, for the foreseeable future. And if it works out, maybe that's where we'll stay. I don't know. It would make a big difference in? It would change everything. When Mike and Kathy have to be away from the mic, we truncate the program and it's only 2 hours instead of the full 3 hours. If we keep it at this in this slot, that wouldn't have to happen anymore. We'd have the full 3 hours, so, and then still plenty of time to turn the program around and get things ready when I sit in for Mike. So that's another thing that makes it worth considering. And of course, every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude. It is time to thank our subscribers for the 10th day of the month. A reminder, the 9th day of the month is now the official loneliest day of the month for subscribers on The Horn. Our buddy Khalil is holding down the fort over on the, you know, on the previous day, the 9th. But on the 10th, we have set thanks to send out to Don and Judy and Daniel. Thank you very kindly indeed for being partial sponsors of the program. I cannot thank you enough. Thank you so very, very much. Not just on my behalf or on Agnes and my behalf, but on behalf of the entire community for whom you help keep this program and make this program free to anyone who wants to listen. Remember, as far as the funding of the program goes, we've got one contributor for every 100 listeners. Imagine that. Yeah. So that's where things stand. And I can say happily that thanks to an anonymous contributor, it is fundraising free radio all week. We had a have a week on me contribution come in. And so we don't have to do any fundraising this week. We'll get back to it. We'll get back to it on December the 16th, this coming Monday. Okay. That makes things downright pleasant. And hey, thanks to everybody who says the audio sounds good. Much obliged. I do appreciate it. It's nice to hear that. And Jesus, Steve from Georgia, Stan, all around great guy. Just trying to go, just working on a little aneurysm there. Question subject line, Steve. What time does the show start, Bob? 5 Eastern. God damn it, 5 Eastern. Thank you, Steve. Thank you. And a reminder, if you would like to be part of the Merry Madcap Wacky Zany real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn Chat Room, it's up and running, as it always is, during the hours in which the program is live from 5 to 8 Eastern Standard Time. Ah, you thought I was gonna screw up, didn't you? I didn't. I may be a little bit buzzy this evening because I treated myself to a cup of, because I'm kind of taking it easy on the coffee and stuff because it makes me want to smoke real bad. But, you know, haven't had a cigarette in, you know, a couple of hours, and it'll be 3 hours through the program without one, and we'll just, you know, letting go now, letting everything go. Jesus, that almost turned into a test tone. Sorry for any, if I bothered anybody's woofers, I apologize. But no, I got a nice cup of oolong tea, and you know it doesn't have much caffeine, but it has some caffeine, so it might, as sensitive as I am to the stuff. I don't know. I may wind up sounding like an auctioneer on crack or something by the time this program's over. But anyway, if you want to jump into the Horn Chat Room, early arrivers Jimmy and Squeaky are waiting for you. And, of course, capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, although a third-stage guild navigator, has elected once again not to fold space. Of course, pinch-hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan, who wants to know what time does the show start every day. Yeah. I've got a monitor on in the background, a TV monitor. It's not DirecTV now, whatever it's called. And I got to tell you, if you're listening to this program, you're way out ahead in terms of other stuff going on in the 5 p.m. Eastern hour, because your other choice might be to be over on MSNBC watching the unbearable, the unbearably smug, for no apparent discernible reason, Chuck Todd, as he blathers away at climate change denier and wingnut welfare recipient Brett Stevens. I think that's reason enough to stay tuned into the Horn myself. No Brett Stevens. Brett Stevens free radio. There's no Brett Stevenses here. There's no Republicans at all. No Republicans, no birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, birchers, booger eaters, maggots, trumpansies, libertarians. None of them here. The horn is a little oasis of sanity away from all the hoopla of the madding crowd. You see, in the horn's mission statement, there's a sanity clause. Yeah, you can't fool me. I know there ain't no sanity clause. Oh, yes, there is. Yeah, no cigarettes for three. You know what? It was no smokes for 3 hours when I got up this morning. And it's no smokes for 4 or 5 hours right here. So that's 8 hours out of a 24-hour day. The other eight, I'm sleeping. So that's 13 hours. All I got to do is figure out what to do with the other 11. I think we can do this. No guarantees, but I'm trying. I'm really trying. And I can tell because my lungs are like, hey, you know, my lungs are fighting against my Jones right now. My lungs are like, ah, what? Yes. And my Jones is like, yeah, goddamn, get out of the bunker, get somebody, give me some nicotine. So we'll see who comes out on the long end of the stick as far as that's concerned. I'm rooting for my non-Jones. And I think, this gives you a good idea. I had a note earlier from Shorty in L.A. Full disclosure, I got cranky after your show last night because I had to wait for one tiny hour from Loy. It was just 60 minutes, right? Incoming pity party. I'm such a lollipop. I've been regimented my whole life. Yes, it's kept me out of prison. Yes, I'm good at routine, blah, blah, blah. Just whining, not blame. Because of family rearing, my mother made sure that all of her girls had no excuses for being in a faulty relationship, sticking up to the whining-ass wannabe slick men of the earth, especially a black man who knew better. We're to have zero tolerance for ways of living that don't complement creation. Yeah, though, insert, when I did get in trouble daily, she always asked me in a 3-to-6-part question, so, sweetie, what happened in the end? Who's at fault? Was there stingy intent by you? Did they listen to you? Were you without well-taught morals? Did they apologize? Did you? Of course, answering Mama, M-A-M-M-A-H, her spelling, says Shorty in L.A., was like answering that famous reporter from the White House briefings, Helen Thomas. After I said, whew, to her questions, thinking I made it out of a butt whooping, my dumb butt's feeling pretty good, right? I missed the question. Wait for it. Screech. Oh, yeah, sweetie, who benefited as a result of all of it? We don't ever get away, says Shorty. We're free because our parents got tired of f***ing with us. We get to run and skip because they gave us a break from tearing that ass up, LMAO. Saying all of that to come to the realization that, one, my cigarette smoking is a relationship. Two, it does not complement the earth nor creation. Three, I am tolerating my cigarette smoking. Four, in the end, possible because of my death could be due to cigarettes. Five, the beneficiary is all of those that profit from me buying and smoking cigarettes. The very encouraging part is, Shorty continues, that my mother stopped smoking, get this, at age 58. I know she was close to 60. She died at age 89. Never had cancer. Smoked during pregnancies only, and two of her eight children smoke. So screw all those naysayers thinking that people who quit in their late 50s will still get lung cancer after they quit. I was a lollipop yesterday in LMAO because I just put one out, but that was the only cigarette in the room, and I have no idea where I threw the other cigarettes. My challenge was to not find the pack I threw. My new challenge is to not look for them. My next challenge, to not bring them in the house. Then, do not buy any, which is the hardest part for me. And that was about 15 minutes before airtime. Well, you know what? They're not in the studio with me either. They are out in the car under lock and key. So we'll just get through this. We'll absolutely get through this. I did say sanity clause. Lee in New York says, did you say sanity clause? Let me guess. The sanity clause was ratified on December 25th. Of course it was. Actually, I'm an honest thief. I stole that from the Marx Brothers. That's an exchange between Chico and Groucho. And Chico's the one who says, you can't fool me. There ain't no sanity clause. Yeah. Jim says, easy does it. Right, Bob, slow down. Well, that's not the Jones. That's the wee tiny little bit of caffeine that you get with oolong tea. Doesn't pack near the caffeine wallop that, say, black tea does. And it just has such an intriguing flavor. No sugar. Using Splenda with it. I'll get emails.
Shit's gonna kill you, Bob.
Okay. But it tastes mighty good. So that's it. How was your day? I'm just sort of having fun with all of this. And in a way, I'm also trying to ease us into the consideration of the day. Of course, this was another day for Republicans, maggots throwing fits and having hissies and crying. And by the way, I know it's not exactly breaking news, but to anybody paying attention, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is a mendacious twerp. Emphasis on twerp. His damn near tearful monologue after Gerald Nadler announced the articles of impeachment. Now, let's not get ahead of ourselves. All they did was announce the articles. There's not been a vote. These are just the articles that have been drafted and put forward. And now we have to sit a few days and let the Republicans weep and wail and gnash their teeth and scream and throw fits and hold their breath till they turn blue. Do it. Do it. Hold your breath. I want... all I want for Christmas is for Matt gets to turn blue. Matt gets to turn blue. Matt gets to turn blue. And, you know, he'd rather hold his breath anyway, because usually when he doesn't hold his breath, somebody sticks one of those little portable breathalyzers in front of him and then doesn't charge him with DUI. But it was conniptions as far as the eye could see and the ear could hear today, as Kevin McCarthy and various other maggots threw their hissies when the articles of impeachment, only two, were announced. And like I said, Kevin McCarthy is a mendacious twerp, because his pity party and his outrage calling of the whambulance didn't have very many facts in it. Consider, and this one just leapt out of the screen at me. I think I actually had my back turned to it at the time. He was talking and he said, "And those goddamn Democrats didn't let the minority call no witnesses." And 15 seconds later, he was quoting the minority witness that the Republicans called, you know, Jonathan Turdley. They don't care. They know who their audience is. They know who they're talking to. And I know that Emery and Marveline are not going to do what I just did, and that is pay enough attention to catch them in their bullshit. You know, you say,
Democrats wouldn't let us call any witnesses, a minority. And then he said, we watched a hearing, a Democrat constitutional scholar that did not vote for President Trump say this was the weakest, thinnest, the fastest impeachment in the history of America. He then went on to say if there was an abuse, it would be abuse on the Democrats to move forward. The speaker must not have listened to that hearing. If the speaker had only waited 48 hours to release the transcript, America would not be put through the nightmare.
Do you feel like you're in a nightmare? Because I don't feel like I'm in a nightmare. Today sort of felt a little bit like waking up from one. You know, where you wake up and your head's got a sheen of sweat on it, and you're going, because maybe the sleep apnea kicked in or something, and that's where the nightmare came from, because it was your subconscious trying to wake up, stupid, and you, and the nightmare's over. Well, the nightmare's not over. We're still in the nightmare. But today felt like a step toward getting well, if that's ever even going to be possible. Oh, great, my chair's developed a squeak. Sounds like a goddamn Wookiee. Never a dull moment. But the articles of impeachment came out, and then there's Kevin McCarthy squealing that the IG report says that, you know, of the whole investigation of Nitwit Nero's filthy campaign, that the IG report says that he was spied on by the FBI. It doesn't. Yeah, let's check in with old Kevers there. Never mind me doing him. Let's let him do himself, shall we? Working. We'll get there in a minute.
We watched in a hearing a Democrat constitutional scholar that did not vote for President Trump say this was the weakest.
Shh, Turley's not a Democrat.
The fastest impeachment in the history of America. He then went to say if there was an abuse, it'd be abuse on the Democrats to move forward.
You know why he said that? He said that because he said that the Democrats ought to wait for finality on all the myriad court cases that they have against Donald Trump. You won't hear Kevin Mendacious Twerp McCarthy say that, but he did. And what a tableau we have here. There's that one skinhead Republican dude, and he's flanked by, wait a minute, how in the fuck did Dick Cheney get in? Yeah, oh, it only looks like Dick Cheney in a bad wig. That's Liz. But he said that Jonathan Turley, who is not a Democrat, said that the Republicans or the Democrats were moving too fast. And of course, everybody disagreed with him because he's wrong. And by everybody, I don't just mean the three lawyers that were there with him on the panel. I mean Jeffrey Toobin, Lawrence Tribe, the single most expert human being regarding the Constitution of the United States in the United States today. But the part that Kevin McCarthy did not bring up is that he was questioned, Turley was, and he confessed that if the Democrats did what he, Jonathan Turley, thought they ought to do and waited until all these Supreme Court cases were final, that once there had been a final judgment compelling Donald Trump to do what the subpoenas called for him to do in the first place, that then, once those judgments were final, that the Democrats would be absolutely within their rights to impeach his sorry orange ass. I presume it's orange. I don't want to know. And then there's, you know, there's some truth into it if that's what you want to hang around and wait around to do. Because Adam Schiff had a good point today saying, so what do they want us to do? What's the minority want us to do? Sit around and let him wreck another presidential election? Can we afford that? Is that a luxury that we have? Because it doesn't feel like it is. But it does jibe with what I had said in the past, namely that once these cases become res judicata, once there's nothing more to be litigated out of them, then under any theory, impeachment becomes unavoidable and conviction becomes a fait accompli if the senators trying the bill of impeachment have anything resembling honor and commitment to the oath that they took. Now, this will, of course, let out practically all the Republicans and at least two Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin? Because for them, it's all about politics. But it was painful to watch this thing with Kevin McCarthy as he openly and notoriously lied to the American people. Because I knew that there are far too many people out there who would take him at his word because they don't have the essential knowledge necessary to be able to say, oh, you know, we've got it here in the Horn Family Community Congregation. There's no doubt that we've got it. We've got that requisite knowledge. So we can listen to him and say, oh, what a mendacious twerp. The password is twerp. Kind of got to pop the P so people won't think that I'm saying twerk. Isn't it amazing what a little bit of caffeine will do? But America doesn't have that. And the question becomes one of how do you get that knowledge to them? You know how much I hate the word tribal, but people are broken off into their camps. The people who most desperately need to know that the things that Kevin McCarthy was saying today were abject lies are people who are not going to watch any media that are going to tell them that what he was saying was abject lies. I mean, what are the odds that that's going to be said over on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda? Fucker Carlson's never going to say it. Sean Hannity job, that life support system for a haircut's never going to say it. Ava Braun, Laura Ingraham's never going to say it. How do you get the information to them? Over at Onan, the network that spills its news upon the ground, they're not going to smarten up the chumps. Keeping the chumps stupid is a big dollar. You better believe it. And the check keeps clearing and clearing and clearing. So what motivation do they have to do anything different? And I don't necessarily want to do the whole, you know, talk about this for the entire 3 hours, but it does have to be addressed. How do we become a self-governing Or how do we remain, to the extent that we still are, a self-governing nation if a significant plurality, God forbid it's a majority, but if a significant plurality of the people in the country think they're engaging in self-governance and all they're doing is doing what they're fucking told? How do you do that? This is the kind of stuff that I sit around and think about. Because you see people going through their ordinary lives, their extraordinary, ordinary lives, because living in a country where whatever it is you make a year, you're spending your existence carrying a handful of billionaires on your fucking back. That is extraordinary. It takes tremendous drive and dedication to carry billionaires on your back. And we do. And don't kid yourself. I don't care. Well, you know, Donald Trump's not really a billionaire. But I don't care who the billionaire is. I don't care if it's Tom Steyer or AOB. You know, Michael Bloomberg, another old billionaire. I don't care which one it is. I don't care if they're not a billionaire and instead they're just a hundreds of millionaire or a tens of millionaire. Whatever they are, whoever they are, we are carrying them on our backs because they don't have the capacity to make the planes run marginally on time or keep them in the air. They don't have the capacity to make sure that there are people who will make keep corporations from running wild and making and the cars all exploding all over creation. Billionaires don't have the money to run a National Weather Service or a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Those are all paid for with our taxes. We carry them on our backs.
Quit telling us how to engage in self-government, Bob. <don't know>.
Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you. But it's true. And people think, and all you got to do is look around in your daily life. People are leading their lives, but if you walked up to them and say, hey, bub, what's in Federalist 10? 99 people out of 100 would go, fuck, what's a Federalist 10? Okay, what's in any Federalist paper?
I don't know. Is that liberal media?
See, we think we know about self-governance, but we so don't. And so the people who think that they're being patriotic Americans, I mean, I saw a sign today while I was out, and it was in a store, and it said,
we kneel for the cross. We kneel for God.
No.
We kneel to pray and stand for the flag.
Hey, Jesus. And back to Kevin McCarthy.
The speaker must not have listened to that hearing. If the speaker had only waited 48 hours... to release of the transcript, America would not be put through the nightmare. If the speaker would pause and read the IG report, the Inspector General, to thank in a place of America that we would have a law enforcement agency spy on a presidential campaign in more than 51 instances.
See, that's what I meant. There's nothing in the IG report that says that anybody spied any governmental agency, whether it was the FBI or that anybody spied on Donald Trump's campaign. It's simply not there. But Kevin McCarthy is a mendacious twerp. And so he says it anyway. Because he knows that nobody at Fox News TV Radio Rwanda is going to call him on it, and they're certainly not going to call him on it over at ONN, the network that spills its news upon the ground. So he can just get away with it. And it doesn't matter if somebody like CNN or MSNBC calls him on it or any other outfit, because Emery and Marveline and the rest of the maggots aren't watching that Lügenpresse. See what a little trick box this is? I mean, the high comedy of Kevin McCarthy suggesting that he has anything remotely resembling the same intelligence as Nancy Pelosi alone is worthy of derision. And see, again, while the IG report doesn't say that he was spied, that Trump's campaign was spied on, all day long they've been running clips of some interview that a reporter with NBC News got with Bill Barr to prosecution. Curiously enough, one of the questions is not, "Sir, how do you still have a law license?" I guess it's going to air this evening or something for the world exclusive, what have you. But Barr has said that he thinks, he regardless of what the IG said, "Hey, my God, they're spying." And so that's what Bill Barr to prosecution is going to say. And the next head that's going to find itself on the block is Christopher Wray. Oh, hell yeah. The director of the FBI. And as he has been referred to all day long in the multimillionaire media, the for-profit media, Donald Trump's hand-picked FBI director, Christopher Wray. I mean, this is one of the few people who isn't acting within this regime. He was really honest to Jesus, no kidding, confirmed by the Senate as director of the FBI. And so when the Inspector General of the Department of Justice released his conclusions, that would be Michael Horowitz. And when Bill Barr to prosecution started throwing a hissy about the conclusions that he reached, Christopher Wray, and look, let's not get out the laurels and hearty handshakes just yet, because remember, you don't get to be Donald Trump's director of the FBI without something being grievously and fundamentally wrong with you. John Durham, who is a U.S. attorney who used to actually enjoy a half decent reputation, has flushed that down the toilet by running along behind Bill Barr to prosecution and saying he disagrees with the IG report too. For John Durham to introduce a statement when his own report is not over and is, well, you get the idea. It was so blatantly and obviously a fix that it left the people who watched the stylized performances, the stylized performance art of a postmodern empire, it left them sort of shaking their heads and wondering what was going on in their world. But Christopher Wray decided that he would openly disagree with Comb Over Caligula and Bill Barr and John Durham . Well, he said the inspector general did not find political bias or improper motivations impacting the opening of the investigation or the decision to use certain investigative tools during the investigations, including FISA. He said, I fully accept the results of the IG's report. And this, in turn, led Nitwit Nero to make some grunts and clicks that indicate that, well, it may be time to fire him too, just like he fired James Comey. Because Venerial Vespasian had a date today. Oh, yeah, a hot date. He had a date with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Yeah, who wants only best thing for United States of America, and is not puppet of Putin and does not rely on Vladimir Putin for his very existence, and will not be given polonium enema if he comes away without maintaining ownership of Donald Trump. None of that will happen.
Yeah, Sergei Lavrov came to visit the White House today. And at the same time, as he engaged in his morning twoops, Nitwit Nero went after his own FBI director. And look, it's not unusual because this guy is a raving paranoid maniac. So, of course, he's going to go after his own FBI director, because anyone who disagrees with him is therefore out to get him.
I don't know what report current director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, was reading.
Current director of the FBI? That sounds a little temporal, doesn't it?
I don't know what report current director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, was reading. But it sure wasn't the one given to me. With that kind of attitude, he will never be able to fix the FBI, which is badly broken, despite having some of the greatest men and women working there.
Nothing in the IG report about the FBI being badly broken. What a time to be alive. And it was funny because there was a bit of continuity. The last time that Chlamydia Claudius got together with his totally not corrupt pal, Sergei Lavrov. The last time that happened, he canned James Comey in the immediate aftermath. I mean, what are they just bringing his orders in the fucking diplomatic pouch? Well, look, if he does shit can Christopher Wray, I'm not going to be doing a lot of weeping. Because if you go and you have sex with a prostitute in the seedier part of town, and a couple of weeks later it starts hurting when you pee, well, it's not like you didn't do that to yourself. And that's where Christopher Wray is. Nobody put a gun into his head and made him be FBI director under Donald Trump. And anybody in their right mind, and especially a guy like Christopher Wray, should have looked and said, oh, fuck. This guy's dirty. Maybe I'd rather have a reputation than be a director of the FBI. Maybe I'd rather have my dignity intact than be director of the FBI. Everything that Donald Trump touches becomes inexorably corrupted. It's a law of nature like fucking gravity. Ah, true, true. Lee in New York pointing out, subject line, morning twoop. Don't forget that each of Donald Trump's morning twoops is followed by 10
to 15 flushes.
No, he's got nothing better to do than to stand there waiting for the tank to refill. That probably takes up a full hour of his executive time every morning. What's that? Kyle says, well, thank you, Kyle. Kyle says, I wish you good luck on your continuing effort to quit smoking for good. I've just entered my third decade on this earth and have already sworn it off and stopped three times only to pick it back up again. I hope you're able to say goodbye to smoke forever and trust me, I know how hard it is. Well, hey, I'm, 2 hours and 46 minutes now without a smoke. We'll get there. Oh, and Stephen had a question right before the show, and I need to, the program, I need to answer. Stephen asked via email, which model Acorn do I have? There's now a ceramic Acorn. I don't have that. I've got the lesser model, the artificially insulated or whatever model Acorn. Not the little tabletop fucker. But no, this is the full-sized Acorn. It's just not ceramic because the ceramic goes on up to like $675 or something, which is still a bargain as compared to Kamado Joe's and big green eggs and things like that. Tiny little green eggs are like $1,000. So it's just and it works great. Steve, with a note, subject line, Matt gets gift suggestions. Steve says, as a lefty, I'm a giver. I also care about people's health. I was thinking of sending Matt Getz a box of condoms because I'm concerned he's going to get something from filleting nitwit Nero so much. I would welcome the Horn Family Community Congregation's thoughts. Well, should they be flavored? Maybe instead of like the typical cherry or strawberry, we should commission some one-of-a-kind, kumquat-flavored condoms for Matt Getz. What do you think? What do you think, Steve? I think it has potential. Oh, Flavio had a question earlier. Why aren't any of the two impeachment articles about emoluments? Violations of the Emoluments Clause abound. Ah, I haven't... Maybe that was a rhetorical question, and Flavio's waiting to see if I know the right answer. As far as I can tell looking at it, the reason there's no emoluments clause article is because the emoluments clause has not been thoroughly interpreted by the Supreme Court, because while there are some emoluments cases out there, there's nothing directly on point, and all of this would be a case of first impression. And so consequently, you've kind of got to let it go all the way through the system and let the Supreme Court rule before you can charge him with an emoluments clause violation, even though it seems to anybody with two brain cells to rub together that he's obviously violated the hell out of the emoluments clause. You've got to have a court say that he did. I mean, you don't have to, but because there's no finality to it, it just means that if you included an emoluments clause charge in a bill of impeachment, that it would just go over to the Senate and it would be turned into a goddamn circus, and there would be, in the end, no meaningful resolution. And remember, I don't care what kind of bill of impeachment goes to the Senate. It is going to be shit canned. Okay? Is this one of those wake-up moments that we've so desperately needed? Or that we need from time to time? This is going nowhere. The final analysis by the historians, depending on who's writing the history, will be that the Democrats who crafted these two articles of impeachment to go into a single bill of impeachment, history will say that they honored their oath. And it's not even a foregone conclusion, I suppose, that this bill of impeachment is going to pass the House. I don't think Nancy Pelosi would even let it come to a floor vote if she didn't know for a fact that she had the votes to pass it. But one never counts unhatched chickens. Because some of them don't hatch. Just rot in the nest. And some of them hatch, and well, damn, that's a little baby rattlesnake. That's 13 little baby rattlesnakes. Son of a bitch. We have cliches for a reason. So when it does get scheduled, because remember, going forward, we're going to have floor debate on this. And since it's such a weighty matter, we'll have 3 or 4, maybe 5, 6 hours of floor debate about it. 3 hours for the Democrats, 3 hours for the Republicans, maybe 8, maybe 10, who knows? And there will be more pontificating than at a meeting of the College of Cardinals. And only after that, and after, Mr. Speaker, I would like to amend that there, the account. I'd like to amend Article 1 of the Bill of Impeachment to include the fact that we need to impeach Bill Clinton some more, and I want to impeach Barack Obama. You think I'm kidding? These jackasses have been saying that you can impeach, they can, the Republicans claim they could impeach Barack Obama, who isn't even in office. That's how far gone they are. You heard the clip, if you listened to the program from the 9th, you heard the clip from Louis Asparagus Gohmert saying exactly goddamn that. It's a breathtaking level of stupidity. And so there will be, amending and motion making. Jesus Christ, it'll be madness. Oh, sorry, Flavio. I mentioned Orange Backside a little while ago, and Flavio said, you just ruined dinner in the Central Time Zone. True, I guess. Sorry. But only after we've had a day full or more of pontificating will we have an actual vote on the articles of impeachment. And somewhere along the way, they will have to select House managers whose job will be to lead the prosecution in the Senate trial. You remember the Senate trial of Bill Clinton? You remember the House managers that they sent over? All those clips that we have of Precious Lindsey talking about how the minute that he refused to respond to a subpoena, Richard Nixon became impeachable. Yeah. That Lindsey Graham, he said that shit when he was a House impeachment manager. And because he impeached that dirty, dirty Democrat president for that nasty old blow job, what he done got the people of South Carolina rewarded him with a seat in the Senate of the United States of America. I know. Flavio says, hit those hick accents. I'm just so sick of those horrible Hicksville accents. But they serve their purpose, Flavio. And the purpose they serve is to remind us that the same people who are trying to protect and preserve the criminality and the overt manifest corruption of Nitwit Nero are the sons, well, not the sons, but the great-great-grandsons, etc., of the same people who shrieked in the Congress that we could never take away the South's right to own other human beings. They are the direct genealogical political descendants. Oh, sure, they've got an R after their name now, and back then they had D's after their names, but the philosophy is the same. And so, look, I know that Doug Mouthful of Collards Collins is driving you batshit. I know that, Flavio. But it's not like, Kevin McCarthy doesn't have a Hicksville accent. Why, by God, he's a good California feller. It just seems like the ones with the cornpone accents are in positions where we hear from them most often, like Doug Mouthful of Collards Collins. Oh, shit, I know. Let me give you the amen, David in South Carolina, Stan. Responding to Flavio, David in South Carolina, Stan says, those hick accents, you're so sick of those hick accents? Try living in the midst of those people with those accents down here. Your point is... Well, your point's not, your nail is not driven, your nail is countersunk, David. Correction coming from Steve in New York. Yeah, I'm not sure I'd call the debate on impeachment debate. I think it'll just be more like speeches from those wanting to speak. Nobody will convince anyone of anything. In other words, it'll be exactly like all the other debates. In the Capitol. Debate doesn't carry the day. And don't try to convince yourself that there was some Halcon day when it did. It's just groups of people talking past one another. and thus has it ever been. By the way, Brother Deacon Asa notes, these morons, the Democrats, are clueless where it concerns messaging. Let me tell you how pig fuckers would spin at the IG report if the shoe was on the other foot. You're damn right we eavesdropped on the Trump campaign. It was a counterintelligence operation against a Russian asset that was attempting to seize power from the American people. Trying to tippy-toe around it like the Democrats are doing will only make Emery and Marbling dig in deeper. Sometimes it's more politically... Oh, I'm sorry. Sometimes it's more politically expedient to embrace what one is accused of and use it to hit back at the maggots. Well, there's a winning. There's a winning remark. Brother Deacon Asa asks, if we can impeach Clinton for getting a blowjob from an American citizen, why can't we impeach Trump for giving several to foreign dictators? Ooh. Beauty, eh? Lee with a question, emoluments. What about the foreign meeting Pence attended where he stayed at a nearby facility? It just happened to be owned by Trump and was 200 miles away. I think that's a separate kind of corruption. Because what because that was the government putting money in Donald Trump's pocket, and the emoluments clause speaks specifically, I believe, to foreign money and its corrupting influence on a government official. It's dirty, but you're going to need a different kind of math for it than the emoluments clause. So, hey, we've come up on the close of the first hour. And I should note that both lines are open. This is, after all, conversation radio. And you're welcome to participate. More than. Yeah, over on Skype. Or on that line, 304-574-8178, or Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. It's easy. And the stress line remains a viable possibility. That number, 844-843-4676. 844-843-4676. That's if you like spelling on your keypad, that's 844 the horn, THEHORN. Brother Deacon Asa set it up all groovy like that because Brother Deacon Asa is clever that way. And, of course, it is Tuesday, so that means that we have the Green News Report, courtesy of Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. Oh, and just a reminder here at the top of the hour, and there are great big splashy banners all over HeadOn.live. For those of you who already know this, I apologize, but a lot of people don't. We have changed for the foreseeable future, we've changed the airtime of the program. Used to be 6 to 9 Eastern time. Now it is 5 to 8. 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time works out to 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and all times in the middle. Doesn't matter to the podcast audience, podcast community, but it does matter to folks who like to tune in the program live. And as Steve from Georgia Stan pointed out, there's kind of a paucity of good progressive broadcasting in the 5 o'clock hour. So maybe we can bring more people into the conversation this way. And please help out. You really can if you stop telling us how to do social media, Bob. But really, if you follow me on Twitter, and if I say something that's remotely interesting or funny or something, don't just sit there and click and like it. Retweet it. Lately, I'm not putting a whole bunch of stuff on Facebook, but I put some on there. And as God, I think it was our buddy James in Spain, maybe, who said it. When I posted the Skype link onto my Facebook page the other night, he said, "We all need to be sharing this." See, the thing that makes the difference in social media isn't liking something; it is moving it on in the universe of ideas, the marketplace of ideas. So over on Twitter, retweet. On Facebook, share. Don't just click the little heart button or the little, you know, laughy button or whatever. Do that if you want to. But if you want to help grow the program, share the program. If you find the program interesting, intriguing, if you like the filibobsters, if you like the conversations amongst the community, whatever your favorite day of the week is, tell other liberals and progressives about it. And we will grow the program that way. And that'll be freaking awesome. Okay? So anyway, like I said, it being a Tuesday, this in particular, the 10th day of December 2019, we've got the Green News Report. And as such, well, let's see what Brad and Desi are up to. Yeah, I like that.
It's Tuesday, December 10, 2019.
Three bushfires burning north of Sydney have joined to create what's been dubbed a mega blaze.
New heat wave exacerbates Australia's bushfires, now raging out of control.
The world's oceans are struggling to breathe.
Oceans losing oxygen thanks to man-made global warming. Plus,
we would love some action from the people in power.
Young activists pressure UN Climate Summit to get moving.
All of that pressure and more straight ahead from Brad blog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
People are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once.
No, they're not. You're just making that up. This is your Green News Report. You and your toilet must really be full of Okay, Desi Doyen, what the hell is Donald Trump talking about with the flushing the toilets 10, 15 times?
Oh, Trump is now going after water efficiency rules that save consumers money. Trump falsely claimed last week that he ordered a federal review of water efficiency standards for bathroom fixtures. But in reality, it was the Republican-controlled Congress back in 2018 that mandated that the EPA review all regulations implemented by the Obama administration prior to 2012.
So this was meant to save water, these low-flow toilets, and now he's claiming it's using up more water.
And he's wrong about that.
What a surprise.
EPA data says that updated water efficiency standards actually save the average family nearly $400 in water costs every single year.
Oh, well, we need to stop that right away.
In eastern Australia, more than 100 out-of-control fires continue to rage amid a prolonged severe drought and yet another heat wave. Air quality has reached hazardous levels in Sydney, where over the weekend, three three major fires joined together to create a mega blaze stretching more than 37 square miles. Mm. The heavy smoke closed ferry service in Sydney Harbour and is so bad it even set off smoke alarms at the University of New South Wales. Rural Fire Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons warned residents that the fire situation is going to get worse before it gets better.
We've got a significant number of fires which are joining together and will continue likely to join together over the coming days and weeks, given the access, the terrain, and the volatility of fire behaviour and how quickly these fires are spreading.
I'll tell you what, for the last, 3, 4, 5 years, every December, it seems like we get this same story out of Australia.
Yep, and worse, the smoke and soot from Australia's fires are turning New Zealand's glaciers pink, 1,200 miles away.
Of course, that deadly volcano in New Zealand isn't doing much either for soot around that country.
It certainly isn't. In California, bankrupt utility Pacific Gas and Electric has agreed to pay $13.5 billion to settle claims arising from the deadly 2017 Wine Country fires and the 2018 Camp Fire that killed 85 people in the town of Paradise.
Did you say $13 billion?
Yes. PG&E admits those fires were caused by its failure to maintain its equipment. If approved, that $13 billion settlement with victims would be in addition to a previous $1 billion settlement with cities and an additional $11 billion settlement with insurance carriers.
That company is already in bankruptcy. Now is the time for California to buy it up, I say.
Meanwhile, a new study warns that oxygen levels are falling in the world's oceans. Warmer seawater holds less oxygen, and the researchers calculated that 50% of the oxygen loss in the upper part of the ocean since 1950 is a result of man-made global warming. The rest is caused by nutrient runoff from agriculture and industry. The loss of oxygen has a wide range of consequences for marine biodiversity, and it affects the everyday functions of ocean ecosystems.
Which means that fish and other wildlife in the oceans die for lack of oxygen.
Right. In Madrid, Spain, inside this year's annual United Nations Climate Summit to negotiate the Paris Climate Agreement, world governments are deadlocked on a number of measures, including an attempt to create a global carbon pricing mechanism. Outside the conference, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets demanding that negotiators do more in a Friday school strike for climate led by teen climate activist Greta Thunberg. In a press conference, Thunberg and the other youth climate leaders excoriated world leaders for not moving fast enough, even as climate scientists' warnings become increasingly dire.
The climate crisis is still being ignored by those in power, and we cannot go on like this. It is not a sustainable solution that children skip school. We cannot go on like that. We don't want to continue, so we would love some action from the people in power.
Yeah, but we need you to continue, Greta. You and all of the thousands of students out there, please keep up the pressure. No pressure, but you're our only hope. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Oh, I do appreciate an obscure film reference in that case from Brad and Desi saying to Greta Thunberg, "You are our only hope." That's straight out of Galaxy Quest.
You are our only hope.
Mm-hmm. Still one of my favorite films for a variety of reasons. But here we are in the second hour of the program. You're probably going to get sick of hearing this, but it's my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's my, we're into my ninth hour of broadcasting without a cigarette. And you know, I'm not bragging about it. I'm not claiming that I've quit. I haven't. I want to be clear about that. But these 3 hours and the couple of hours before the program begins and the hour after are probably the ones where I most associate myself with the vicious addiction of smoking tobacco. Agnes could tell you that a bunch of them just burn up in the ashtray. But it's that security blanket thing and the oral fixation thing. And by the way, last night's cherry Tootsie Pop is still unwrapped. It's still here on the broadcast desk. It has still never made it to my mouth. But it's there in case I just have to, you know, do the oral fixation. No filthy emails, please. And it's every day it's going to be hopefully it's going to become a little bit easier. And if I can kick it during this most intense moment, then maybe I can kick it for the rest of the day. No promises, but maybe. Just maybe. And wouldn't that be awesome? Oh, and hey, as far as, like we were talking about social media a minute ago, you heard Brad and Desi there, you know, share us on the Facebooks and the Twitters and blah, blah, blah. I very seldom say something like that because it just seems, ugh. That's the best I can do. Ugh. But I guess I have to. So in order to grow the program and in order to get the program out so that more people can get it and engage in the conversation, because remember, this isn't capitalism. This is an attempt to foster dialogue among people of goodwill. Now, granted, that automatically lets out all the maggots and probably 99% of the Republicans. I mean, I was watching my Filthy Morning Habit this morning, and I noticed that they had Steve Schmidt on. And I was reminded that he was confirmation of what I've been saying for a while now. All these people that we think are our never Trump friends who get booked and booked and booked and booked and booked and booked and booked on the TV programs, and they come on and they say funny, snarky things about Donald Trump, and we go, ha, 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 ha. My, he certainly, remember, tigers don't change their stripes, and neither do skunks. And so there was Steve Schmidt this morning, gleefully prattling away as to how Elizabeth Warren was a commie socialist and how, what did he say? Dishonest progressivism is no remedy to dishonest Trumpism. And it was sickening because what they were going on about was the fact that somebody dug up doing oppo research on her. You know, as long as it's being done to a Democratic woman, it's vetting. And they found her billing records. And so the for-profit media was, they were all beside themselves this morning up until 9 o'clock when the announcement of the bills of the articles of impeachment hit. They couldn't stop talking. Oh God damn it! Look at who she lawyered for, and oh my God. Yeah, she got paid $2 million. Over 20 years for engaging in some practice of law at, and get this, rates that were at the time below ordinary market value because, of course, women lawyers couldn't make the same as men lawyers. So let's see, $2 million.
divide by 20. So she was billing out $100,000 a year. I know it sounds like a lot. It's not. Not in that consultancy lawyer world. But Jesus Christ, it was like, it was like, well, how about another Galaxy Quest reference? You know, the cute little animals that, and people never seen this? In a minute, that oh, look, they're giving water to that sick one. No, they're getting ready to eat it. Well, in a minute, one of them's going to hit him on the head with a rock. Well, there was Steve Schmidt, and there was noted moderate former member of the United States Senate Claire McCaskill, because she couldn't present a clear distinction between herself and her Republican challenger. She's a friend of Cole, remember, Claire is. Les had a note this morning, saw the same thing I did, said Claire McCaskill, or however you spell her name, and the glee on her face as she talks about Liz Warren's potential downfall, she's happier than all the admitted Republicans on the panel. If she knew so much, how come she lose with her Titanic stupid ass? Well, because she tried to be Republican light, and anytime you give a Republican a choice between Republican light and a real Republican, even if the real Republican is frothing at the goddamn mouth, they will take the real thing every time. And that's what they did in Missouri. But anyway, back to the whole social media thing. I want to thank Renee in D.C. Renee tweets a link out to the program every evening on Twitter. And if everybody else retweeted her tweet, we'd start getting this out into the greater progressive broadcastosphere. And thanks going out to Ralphs. Ralphs is still busy over at Democratic Underground sharing the message, carrying the gospel to a world in darkness. So thank you both. Thank you very kindly. And if I got it wrong, if it wasn't Jim in Spain who said we all need to be sharing this every time Bob put it, if I got it wrong, let me know, and I will thank the appropriate person. But if it was you, Jim, thank you very kindly. And again, if you want to engage in some conversation radio, I'm certainly game for that. 844-843-4676, that's the stress line. And then 304-574-8178, or Bob Kincaid Horn over on Skype. Okay. And what else do we have to look into? You know, there was a bunch of stuff. That's a complicated legal term, bunch of stuff. Oh, let's check some email real quick. Mueller too. Mueller's a Republican, says David in South Carolina, Stan. Oh, hell yes, he is. Yeah. We're out there having the for-profit media multimillionaires are out there having a fit over Elizabeth Warren's money. And as David in South Carolina, Stan, points out, yet Donald Trump can bring in millions and no problem. Sure. But we know why, of course. IOKIYAR. Kyle with a note. The Republican assholes in media who are never Trumpers don't actually hate Trump or his policies. They hate that he's making their party look bad by saying the quiet parts out loud, amen, and not putting a smiley face on racism, bigotry, and misogyny. Plus, they're scared shitless of losing their tax breaks. I would add one more thing to that, Kyle. And maybe y'all get sick of hearing this, but until this is somehow, until this has been disproven, I'm going to keep saying it.
When the Russians hacked the DNC, they hacked the RNC too. There are news stories that confirm this fact. They dumped the DNC because it would do damage. They kept the same, not the same, but they kept the filthy info they got on the Republicans because they knew that they could use that as kompromat and that they could pull the Republicans they had with it, that they had caught in their net like a little red wagon. And so every time you catch yourself saying, you know, God damn, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? What about their oath? Remember, a man named James Wilkinson took an oath to the United States of America too. And he went all the way to the rank of general. And he never had a moment's compunction against violating that oath, and he violated the fuck out of it back in the early 1800s when the Spanish check, the check from the Spanish king, cleared every month. And all he had to do was sell out his young country. So every time you catch yourself saying, why are the Republicans doing this? Tell yourself, stop telling us what to tell ourselves, Bob. Tell yourself, hey, Russia has the RNC emails. They released the Democrat ones. They kept the RNC, and it's serving as a most handy tool. It's like the whip that the buggy driver uses to convince the horse pulling it to do what the buggy driver wants. Tracy with a note, speaking of blowjobs and Precious Lindsay, the more I think about it, I think Precious Lindsay was so upset about Bill Clinton's blowjob because deep down he wishes he could have taken Monica's place. Ooh, that's cold. Just saying, says Tracy. Oh, I know.
Not saying, just saying.
That's the kind of thing they say over in the for-profit media. Kyle says, thank you, Bob. That the Russians kept the RNC emails isn't said enough. Thank you. A fucking man. My sister's looking at me like I'm crazy for yelling thank you at my phone. Dude, are we not far enough along into our subservience to our phones that walking down the street, talking into thin air, is no longer considered crazy? Obligatory Star Trek paraphrase coming from Lee in New York, from A Taste of Armageddon, Kirk. All right, it's instinctive, but the instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands, but we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. Knowing that, we won't kill today. My paraphrase, all right, this is Lee in New York, all right, it's addictive, but the addiction can be fought. We're human beings with the misery of billions of people on our hands, but we can stop it. We can admit that we're smokers, but we're not going to smoke today. That's all it takes, knowing that we won't smoke today. You know, I'm starting. Today is a big word, and it carries too much freight for me. We're starting out with I won't smoke during the program, and then we'll work on it from there. Oh, and my Galaxy Quest reference. Lady B's out there. By Grapthar's hammer, you've done the right thing.
You are our only hope.
Lady B earlier said, I have absolutely nothing of value to contribute to your filibobster right now, so I thought I'd share this. Pigeons spotted wearing tiny cowboy hats in Las Vegas. It's a video, but that's not the point. The point is that this is happening in the world, and we weren't aware of it until now. In my turn, this is real. This is also amusing. And despite it all, it makes sense, because why not? Why shouldn't things be this way? Am I turning this into an existential issue? Again, why not? This is a stupid story that's taking place in a stupid timeline, but this one actually triggers me to contemplate its meaning. Does it make sense? To quote my nephew, only if you don't think about it. But by God, isn't it a great distraction? Says Lady B, happy Tuesday. Outside, it's America. Oh, I know, I know. The story comes from UPI. And yes, it's Dateline today. And pigeons, somebody went and put tiny hats on pigeons. This has in turn triggered the animal rescuers to desperately engaging in an attempt to capture the said pigeons so that they can take their tiny cowboy hats off their heads. A video shows some of the birds are wearing little red cowboy hats as they forage in a Las Vegas parking lot. That's not pigeon. That's squab. Succulent, tender squab. Mariah Hillman, who runs an animal rescue group called Lofty Hopes, said she's concerned about the welfare of the pigeons. At first, I was like, oh my God, that's cute. These are quotes. Okay, I didn't make that up. At first, I was like, oh my God, that's cute. Then I was like, wait a minute. How did they get those hats on there? Did they glue them? And does that mean, and what does that mean for them? Is it something that's going to impede their flight or attract predators? Mariah. 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 Stop it. No singing. Hell, we're not even fundraising this week. Mariah, you know what it is about pigeons that attracts predators of pigeons? Being pigeons. That's why they're here. It's all part of the grand scheme of things. Pigeons aren't apex predators. Pigeons. Well, I mean, we use pigeon as an analogy for victim for a reason. Pigeons are snacks. And not just for, like, cats and stuff. Humans actually eat pigeon. Squab. You ever see squab on a menu? Say to yourself, oh, pigeon. But I do love the level of analysis that Mariah Hillman goes into. What? How did they get those hats on there? Well, they took their little feet, and they picked up the hats and they put them on their heads. I admit the first thing I thought of when I saw the story from Lady B was what Bill Hicks said about the night before November 22nd, 1963. The late great prophet Bill Hicks. Groups of anti-Castro pigeons were seen drinking in bars in Dallas saying, coo, coo. Oh, be happy wherever you are, Bill Hicks. Pigeons with tiny hats. like Lady B says. Does it make sense? Only if you think about it. And outside, it's America. You know, you know what would be awesome? If we ever get around to re-imaging the program in terms of audio and stuff, get Lady B into a studio and use those magnificent pipes of hers to cut a little tiny piece of audio saying, outside, it's America. Wouldn't that be awesome? Lee in New York. Pigeons with cowboy hats. Bob, this is a slippery slope. Pigeons in full cowboy garb. Pigeons with six shooters. Turkeys hire pigeons for Thanksgiving feast revenge. Alfred Hitchcock warned us. Oh, he did. He so did. As to the pigeons with tiny hats, Jim responds, goodness, Bob, goodness. Jesus, this place. What a world, what a world, what a world. And speaking of just plain goddamn bizarre, I got this one. And it really does kind of make you go, hmm. So, out there in the wide, wide world, nah, not really so much that, but it's more a matter of, out there in the Inspector General's report that came out yesterday, there's a lot of fun stuff. For instance, you remember Christopher Steele? He of the Steele dossier, the PP files. Yeah. What Nitwit Nero calls a witch hunt. Because, of course, when people look for dirt on him, it's a witch hunt. But when Republicans do it to Democrats, it's just opposition research. Christopher Steele didn't know what he was going to find. Well, now, thanks to the IG report, we know that he didn't even dislike La Familia Drumpf. Not only did he not dislike them, he liked them. And you know why he liked them? Because he was pals, wait for it. You might want to get the hockey puck. Don't bother the neighbors. Don't go running out the door, eating dirt and running rabbits and hooting like barn owl. Don't do that. Steele felt kind of kindly toward Nitwit Nero's family. Because he'd been pen pals with Princess Iwanka My Daddy Trump since 2007. It was 2007 when Princess Iwanka met Christopher Steele. And then she started emailing with him, saying that she wanted to form a working relationship to have him help them do due diligence in their creepy, corrupt companies. As part of his work for the organization Orbis. Now, he never took the job, but they kept emailing. From at least 2007 to 2010, they were still pen-palling, emailing each other. This is the same Christopher Steele that Princess Iwanka's daddy has been railing against it. Has anybody, you reckon anybody's told the Tangerine Tiberius that his very own daughter was corresponding with Christopher Steele? You think? What do you reckon the kumquat Kaiser would do if he found out that his most precious child, because, you know, fuck him, fuck all the other ones, he cares about Iwanka.
She's so hot. If nobody was looking, I'd probably date her. Jesus.
Wonder if Iwanka had to, like, get the doc to go in and double the dosage and before find out. You think? But speaking of Christopher Steele, and I mentioned the P-tape, well, also in the Inspector General's report, you will find a passage that says that Christopher Steele, in his investigation, found evidence of other sex parties that Donald Trump attended. But he didn't share that with the FBI. Oh, yeah. According to the Daily Mail, the IG includes another claim. Report 113, sources based in St. Petersburg, reported that Trump has paid bribes and engaged in sexual activities in St. Petersburg, including participating in sex parties, but that witnesses had been silenced, i.e. bribed or coerced to disappear. Years ago now, I mentioned that the business of him hiring hookers to pee on the bed where Barack Obama and Michelle Obama slept was not the big, that wasn't the big deal. And of course, the for-profit media, the multimillionaires, helped to screw that all up by making people think that Donald Trump was participating in a golden shower. So when Donald Trump said,
that's a goddamn lie,
it was true. Because they never understood it in the first place. And they're so dainty and goddamn delicate that they didn't have the nerve to try to explain it the way it works or the way it was described in the report. Donald Trump wasn't having sex with the hookers. Donald Trump did not pay hookers to pee on him. He did not pay the hookers to let him pee on them. Because he is the racist son of a Klansman, Donald Trump hired hookers in Moscow to go specifically to the room where President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle stayed, and he paid the hookers to urinate on that empty bed as a symbolic act. of him urinating on the Obamas. Okay? About the only person who got it halfway, who did a decent job of explaining that, was Stephen Colbert. But way back when this was breaking, there were rumors that the really nasty stuff took place in St. Petersburg. And that the really nasty stuff in St. Petersburg had to do with Donald Trump stooping little girls. You know, the kind of thing that his buddy Jeffrey Epstein liked to do. You ever wonder if Epstein's network extended to providing a little hospitality when Donald arrived in St. Petersburg? Hell of a network, wasn't it? God, my daughter sent me a Christmas ornament the other day. I'm sorry, I had to laugh. I know you can't, you're not supposed to, but it was a Christmas ornament, and it was depending from a branch on a Christmas tree, and it was a picture of Jeffrey Epstein. And in words around the photo of Jeffrey Epstein, it said, "This ornament did not hang itself." I'm sorry, I know, it's terrible. Couldn't help it. On a little legal news today, in the state of New York, a trial judge held in favor of ExxonMobil. The Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, had brought suit against ExxonMobil, alleging that ExxonMobil committed fraud against its shareholders in failing to tell them the truth about what ExxonMobil had known all along about climate change, but had suppressed. Well, at the trial court level, Judge Barry Ostrager, and the trial court in New York is referred to as the Supreme Court. It's not like a state, it's what many jurisdictions call the circuit court or the district court. But in trial, Judge Barry Ostrager said that Attorney General Letitia James, quote, produced no testimony from any investor who claimed to have been misled by any disclosure, even though the Office of Attorney General had previously represented it would call such individuals as trial witnesses. Now, see, what you have to understand there is what the judge was saying is he wasn't saying that they withheld the information. He didn't say that ExxonMobil had sat on climate change information while they continued to set fire to the planet. What the judge said is that what ExxonMobil did didn't mislead any shareholders. Because see, the rest of us who live on planet Earth but are not shareholders, well, we can hang fire on a burning planet. Everybody who's not a shareholder can go fuck themselves as far as Judge Ostrager is concerned.
The state failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that ExxonMobil made any material misstatements or omissions about its practices and procedures that misled any reasonable investor.
Because the rest of us who aren't, well, Exxon investors, we can just go fuck ourselves. Fuck right off. The case was styled People of New York versus ExxonMobil. And it was a big deal for a hot minute. Because there is no doubt that ExxonMobil knew for a very long time what the burning of fossil fuels was doing to the climate of planet Earth. But a judge in New York said, fuck the people of planet Earth. The only people who matter on this planet are, by God, shareholders. And the shareholders made their money. The shareholders kept making money. The shareholders kept cashing the checks. The checks kept clearing. And so fuck all y'all. At 350.org issued a response. Dominique Thomas, who was with 350, she said it was disappointing, but she said that they'll keep working to have Exxon be held accountable. She said, quote, despite this ruling, the crucial work to hold the likes of Exxon accountable for climate crimes goes on. This is just the tip of the accountability iceberg. We thank Attorney General Tish James for her diligence in fighting to protect New Yorkers from rogue and reckless polluters. It's a damn shame she couldn't produce a single shareholder who said that they had been misled. How is that? Because every shareholder was misled. Not just one or two. Is that the subjective standard? If I come up to you and I say, the sky is yellow? No, purple. No, sometimes it is. The sky is... No, we're going to have to find a different kind of thing, because sometimes the sky is purple, sometimes it's red, sometimes it's orange, sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's white, sometimes it's dark. If I come up to you and say that I am one of the amorphous multi-limbed aliens from Norblap 9, and you believe me, do you have to show some sort of damages out of your detrimental? You got to show detrimental reliance under the law before you can prove fraud. See, the law says that parties can run around and lie like rugs, but it's only when the money gets hurt that the law becomes aggrieved. So there's no doubt, there's no hiding from the fact that ExxonMobil has known since, what, the 60s, the 70s, that the constant vomiting of all of this carbon into the atmosphere and the heating of the planet was going to wreck the climate. They've known it. Just like the tobacco industry knew about the addictive, disease-causing qualities of tobacco. But regardless, they sat on the information, both the oil companies, ExxonMobil, and the tobacco industry. They sat on the information. And the rest of us out here toddled along, burning our gasoline, smoking our cigarettes. And there you go. But we weren't shareholders. Because in the world of American jurisprudence, remember Bob's rules of the three M's of the law. Manage, the morons, punish the mean ones, and for the love of bleeding Jesus, protect the money. Morons, meanies, and money. That is the sum total in existence of the entirety of American jurisprudence. I don't see anything in this particular story as to whether Letitia James intends to appeal. All she said was that her office will continue to fight to ensure companies are held responsible for actions that undermine and jeopardize the financial health and safety of Americans across our country, and we will continue to fight to end climate change. I got to admit, I kind of wish she hadn't said anything about the financial health and safety. How about leaving the financial part out and just talk about the health and safety? Or maybe in America, the general principle of the health and safety of the American people just doesn't fucking matter. It's only the financial part that matters. And, of course, we got to remember that there's a bunch of people in the United States of America who don't give a flying fuck. Nitwit Nero I guess went out to Iowegia to hold one of his Klan rallies? No, Pennsylvania, I'm sorry. So, naturally, MSNBC sent a camera crew. Kind of the way you send a camera crew to the zoo when you get a story that the monkeys are really flinging a lot of poo in the monkey house. So MSNBC went out to interview the maggots. And my, oh, my, oh, my, they found themselves some dandies. Sheesh. Let's cue this up. Get the hockey puck, as usual.
The campaign says they've seen a record number of new volunteers who've come out since the impeachment inquiry. They tell you about fundraising and donations and things like that. But as we spoke to people here this morning outside the rally in Hershey, the overarching theme is that they believe that this impeachment inquiry could actually be the key to helping him make a more effective case to his voters for 2020. Take a listen to what some of them told us.
There are no facts, no first-hand knowledge, and they're going by on what the so-called expert says happened, and the expert got us into trouble that the United States been in for a while. So
that's Derek Gibson, an individual by the name of Derek Gibson, and we can't trust the experts because the experts got in this trouble that we've been into for a while. I'm a little curious about why the folks doing the editing work there in the studio at MSNBC chose to put an African-American maggot first in their list of, or in their video of Hershey, Pennsylvania maggots, but, well, maybe because it's Hershey, Pennsylvania, and they thought he was made out of chocolate. I got nothing. But he's not the only maggot.
I don't buy that.
Nobody's perfect, and he hasn't been without mistakes. But he certainly has done more things right than wrong. And he's done a lot for this country with jobs and everything, supporting the military and everything.
So I just want to be real clear here. This is, so we start with the African-American guy. We come to a typical white maggot man. But he says he's done so much with jobs, and sure, he's made mistakes, but you do realize what the gravamen of that argument is, don't you? That is Mussolini made the trains run on time. Oh, sure, his bully boys go through the streets and they beat the hell out of people who don't agree with him. And granted, they made Italy live in a reign of fear and terror. But shit, he made the trains run on time. Goddamn. Gotta have some priorities here, don't we? Sure. I mean, sure, he's made some mistakes. Sure, he violated the Constitution. Sure, tried to shake down Ukraine. Sure, he got caught red-handed. Sure, he admitted it all on TV. But damn, he made the trains run on time.
Everything that he does is just wonderful.
I'm breaking up here because I'm very upset today. I'm glad I'm here. But I think it's so hard because, you know, he's done such a great job, and this is the way that he's being treated. It's very upsetting to me.
Governor, people...
Yeah, she was on the verge of tears. I tell you, tears. Because she has invested so much of her sense of self-worth in a sociopathic, intellectually damaged grifter. But don't, for the love of Christ, don't try to tell her that. Hey, let's run over to the stress line and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Bob. It's Darlene.
Darlene, hey, how are you?
Okay, good. Darlene from Connecticut.
Yes, absolutely. Darlene from Connecticut.
One of the leans. Yeah, one of the leans. So I have to confess, I haven't done as deep a dive into this article as I would like. But I did want to talk to you about this this article in New York Magazine about Bill Barr.
Yes.
That came out, like this interview, and I don't know, I guess they call it the Intelligencer section of this. I was stunned about something that I didn't know that he had done that was sort of a spinoff of something that you've been talking about for quite some time about Barr's role in the Iran-Contra scandal. So I don't know. Did you have a chance to see this article at all?
I saw it in passing, but I didn't give it the time that it deserved.
Well, other news media outlets that picked it up, of course, focused on his relationship with Robert Mueller, and the whole thing about how he would subject Mueller to what they called intellectual hazing at the various meetings that they would attend together when he was attorney general, Barr was attorney general, and Robert Mueller was like a deputy assistant or deputy attorney general. But to me, when you look at some of the other things in this article, it's pretty interesting. His whole thing about, how he hates refugees and immigrants, that goes way back to his time when he was attorney general under George Herbert Walker Bush, and that when there in this article they talk about the coup that when there was a coup in Haiti that caused throngs of refugees to flee in boats, Barr set a policy of intercepting them at sea and detaining them at Guantanamo Bay, and the article says outside the purview of U.S. immigration laws. And that, I guess, the policy apparently caused a clash with military leaders, including Dick Cheney. And that, I guess, there was an oral history interview that Barr did, and he said his attitude was, quote, you want 80,000 Haitians to descend on Florida, several on Florida several months before the election. Come on, give me a break. And, of course, we're talking about the election with Bill, you know, against Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton eventually won, right, and made George Herbert Walker Bush a one-term president. So the article does talk about the Iran-Contra scandal, which you've often talked about in terms of Barr's role in it. Although this particular article seems to more or less minimize his Barr's role, and that, you know, Bush complained to Barr, I guess, that after he lost the election, that, and this is according to Bob Woodward's book, Shadow, which I didn't know he had a book called Shadow, but anyway, Bush wanted to put an end to the Iran-Contra investigation. So under the independent counsel statute, Walsh, I guess, who was the independent counsel, Lawrence Walsh, could be fired for misconduct, a move that Barr considered, but he and Bush settled on another solution. Bush simply pardoned all the Iran-Contra defendants.
Right, and it's in that decision to do the pardon, Darlene, where Barr takes credit for telling Bush, no, you can't just pardon Cap Weinberger, in for a penny, in for a pound. Pardon the lot of them.
So it's interesting because in this article they more or less put the onus of that on Bush completely. That is, that Bush simply pardoned all the Iran-Contra defendants, although they said both Barr and Bush settled on another solution, and that must be what you're talking about. They pardoned them all. But in that sentence where it said that, you know, they pardoned all of the Iran-Contra defendants, they impugned that on Bush alone. You see what I'm saying?
I'm pretty sure I'm solid on this. That Barr takes credit for having been the author of that idea. Instead of just pardoning one, pardon them all.
Okay. I mean, I won't gainsay that at all.
Right. I'm
not saying you're wrong. I mean, that
sounds like the kind of thing he'd do, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Oh no, I don't gainsay what you're saying at all. I could totally see him being doing that and proudly stating he did that. But what really shocked me, and you're probably aware of this, but I did not know this, but his role in Whitewater, because according to this article, this was in the final stage of the campaign. This article then immediately follows with, after talking about the Iran-Contra pardoning of all of the defendants. They said that Barr was on a flight to a ceremony with other administration officials, and that a White House aide informed him cryptically, and I'm quoting directly from the article here, with other administration officials, that a White House there was a rumor about a case down in Arkansas involving a savings and loan. And
oh, Jesus, this is like time travel.
Barr did some digging and discovered that the U.S. attorney, and I'm quoting directly from their article, if that's okay. Barr did some digging and discovered that the U.S. attorney in Little Rock was sitting on a criminal referral that mentioned Clinton and a failed real estate venture called the Whitewater Development Corporation. The prosecutor, a Republican, found the case flimsy. And the referral described Bill and Hillary Clinton as witnesses, not suspects. But Barr had been told, this is how the article is casting it, that the prosecutor's conclusion was, quote, cutting them a lot of slack, unquote. And we don't know who told him that. But he later testified, Barr later testified in a deposition, and that he decided to, quote, get the case on the right track, unquote, by escalating it to Washington. Robert Mueller held a meeting with FBI officials and told them to investigate aggressively, just as in any other bank fraud case. The Arkansas prosecutor who felt that the Clintons were just witnesses, not suspects, fired off an angry letter saying the, quote, insistence for urgency suggested an attempt to intervene into the political process of the upcoming presidential election, unquote.
God almighty, I never knew that part.
You didn't. Okay, neither did I. That son of a bitch, he started the Whitewater mess that obviously plagued and dogged Bill Clinton for the, you know, pretty much all the years he was president. And Barr dictated that the investigation would proceed. So because of what this prosecutor in Arkansas had apparently, you know, this prosecutor had fired off this angry letter and said, you're messing with the election. Barr decided, he dictated that the investigation would proceed, quote, you know, but in secret. So as not to interfere.
Wait, you mean like, secret committee hearings of the Congress to make Louis Asparagus Gohmert and all the Republicans lose their minds, only more secret than that? Yeah.
It was in secret. And I guess that Barr's quoted as saying that later a number of Republicans said to Barr, well, hell, why didn't you? You know, why didn't you make it more public? You would have saved the country, unquote.
God.
So,
God, this just beats cats fucking.
Yeah, so it said, with the complaint revived, the FBI continued to investigate the Whitewater case after Barr was gone. Political investigations burn on a long fuse. Yeah, it is a Democratic president.
Well, can we just call a quick time?
And they mentioned Ken Starr. Go ahead. Yep.
Can we just call a quick time out, Darlene, and remind everybody they invented, they investigated the bejesus out of Whitewater and couldn't come up with a goddamned thing. And so only because of the good offices of, what was the judge, David Sentell? Only because they kept, it started out with one prosecutor, and then it went to Ken Starr, and they kept hitting dead ends and going back and getting permission from the judge to broaden the investigation until they finally found the blue dress.
Right, because that's the last sentence here in this particular paragraph. It's funny. An independent counsel, Kenneth Starr, took over the inquiry. Here's the last phrase. And it went in unanticipated directions. It's like, yeah, you think? Yeah, it went in unanticipated directions.
Yeah, somebody gets an understatement award for that. Well, you know, this interview with Barr is out there that he did with NBC, and I saw a clip of it earlier in the day in which he claims that, of course, Donald Trump has done no wrong, but that the greatest danger to democracy, and if you feel the need to hoot like a barn owl when I say this, feel free, because it's really overpowering. The greatest threat to democracy was Barack Obama. Here's the poll quote.
Uh-huh.
I think probably from a civil liberty standpoint, the greatest danger to our free system is that the incumbent government use the apparatus of the state, principally the law enforcement agencies and the intelligence agencies, both to spy on political opponents, but is to use them in a way that could affect the outcome of the election. As far as I'm aware, this is the first time in history that this has been done to a presidential campaign. And if Pete Williams of NBC, I saw the clip and I'm surprised, because if I'd been him, I'd have been slowly sort of, you know, scooting a little further away from Bill Barr. I'm scooting further from the microphone now. Because I'd have been waiting for that goddamn lightning bolt.
Right, yeah. If there was a god, there would be the lightning bolt. Absolutely. And you know, they both, I mean, if you recall, I mean, obviously Clinton won the election and became president, and both Barr and Mueller scooted. They ran from the Justice Department. So I'm actually quite stunned that he had like the key role in unearthing, you know, digging up or generating this false narrative about Whitewater, that would have, to me, it looks retaliatory. It looks retaliatory on his part. And for somebody that, you know, claims that, and actually I believe, what is his name, Jonathan Turley, when he said that, you know, Bill Barr is a Article 2 proponent.
Yeah, he's an Article 2 guy. I'm an Article 1 guy.
Right. I mean, I don't believe that Turley's an Article 1 guy. I think that's as much of a bunch of bullshit as it is saying he's a Democrat. But I do believe that Bill Barr is an Article 2 guy, only if it's a Republican president. You know? I think if it's a Democratic president, it's a whole different, you know, it's a whole different scenario. So I was stunned when I read that. I thought you knew that, so I figured I wasn't saying anything new on this, but that is.
If I did, I'd put it on a brain cell that I negligently killed.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, and to me, that's like one of the big things about this article. And again, they're focusing more on the relationship between him and Mueller, but to me, that's like the big thing. And I guess that what came out of that was that a colleague of Barr, who knew both Barr and Mueller when they were both at Justice during Herbert Walker Bush's term, and of course this particular colleague remains, you know, didn't give his name or her name, but it's probably a he, said that Mueller would say stupid stuff. Like, say Mueller would come out with something really stupid during one of the meetings, and I guess that Barr was like totally merciless in going after him and others. I don't know if I can find that section. But I guess that the whole idea is that William Barr thought of Robert Mueller, like he respected him as a good prosecutor, but did not see Robert Mueller or view Robert Mueller as being a brilliant legal mind. Which then would, then I guess,
or as much of a political sleaze merchant as he himself, Barr, was.
Thank you. Exactly. Because I'm thinking the same to me. Here's the whole thing about this. Barr was always making fun. When Mueller was his subordinate in the 1990s, Barr would often subject him to intellectual hazing. Bill was always making fun of people in his meetings, and Mueller was a particular target of his fun, recalls another former colleague. Mueller would say things that were kind of, Mueller would say things that were kind of stupid at times, and Barr would just mercilessly make fun of him, unquote. The whole idea is that somehow Bill Barr himself is viewed as a brilliant legal mind. And again, I want to do more of a deep dive into this article and look at the sections where it talks about his take on what our founders said, because it diverges, I think, dramatically from what, you know, we talk about in this program, what Dr. Bill talks about in this program. But I'm thinking, is he really brilliant? Or is he just dastardly and devious, and that is mistaken? You know.
I remember a conversation I had a long, long time ago with another unfortunate soul who held a law degree, and we talked about that very topic.
Patty Fogger.
And the thing is, it's the difference between, look, I'm not picking on state schools, but if you go to law school in a state school, they kind of have a mission of churning out lawyers to meet the legal needs of the state. I mean, it influences everything from the size of the class that they admit on an annual basis to how they hire professors. And what he explained to me was that up in the thin air at places like Harvard and Yale, they don't pride themselves on turning out lawyers who know how to live within the law. They pride themselves on turning out lawyers who will find ways to turn the law usually to the advantage of some privileged class. And to say that, look, we got Bill Clinton out of the Ivy League law system, and he's the one who infamously sat in a definition and said, well, it depends on what the definition of is. That is classic Ivy League law school lawyering. If you've got a statute that says you can't dump a barrel of oil in a river, there's some goddamn Yale or Harvard grad out there who will say, well, that doesn't mean we can't dump a million of them. It says a barrel, not a million barrels, Your Honor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to find out, maybe somebody in the Horan community can shed light on where he went to law school, bar, because I'm not seeing it in this article, but I simply could just be missing it.
And if you don't care, I saw reference to it, but I didn't. I don't even know how to find it. Send me a link, would you please?
I can send you the link. I mean, it's pretty interesting. Let me see if I can do that. The University of Virginia Law School is where Robert Mueller went to. Would you consider that to be an Ivy League law school?
It's not in the Ivy League, but they consider themselves to be within that realm. UVA, Michigan, mm-hmm. Stanford, Duke, Vandy, and then the Ivy League itself.
Okay, because, and the Ivy League, because one of the it sounds like a really good law school. I mean, it does sound like a really good law school. One of the interesting reasons why, and I was actually stunned when I learned this, but in a lecture that Robert Mueller gave many years ago at that school, he was called back as an alum to give a speech there. He said that one of the reasons why he went to that law school is because it was one of the few law schools in the country, and this was shocking to me, but I guess for the times it makes sense. Sadly, was that it was one of the few law schools in the country that was willing to open its doors to Vietnam veterans. That because because the war had been so controversial, and that when the men were coming home from Vietnam, and it was so there was a lot of anger directed at the soldiers coming home and the veterans coming home, I guess there were schools of rejecting veterans to go, like him, that wanted to go to law school. And he said that the University of Virginia School of Law actually was accepting veterans. And he said that there was one guy that he sat next to in his class who was a conscientious objector. He said he had long, long hair. He basically came to class barefoot. And,
it was a different time, Darlene.
It was a different time, and I guess that he, like he said, this guy, and he said he didn't, he did not care about, you know, it looked like he didn't care about what he was learning, but he turned out, he said he turned out to be like at the top of the class. And he said that, and somebody in the audience knew who Mueller was talking about, and they were laughing together, and this, they said, you know who I'm talking about, and he goes, now he is an antitrust lawyer, a very successful antitrust lawyer. But he said that he was like one of the more, that was one of the more progressive thinking schools in allowing veterans to learn there at their law school, and that you know, he was sitting in a classroom with veterans that had very, you know, I don't see Robert Mueller as a conscientious objector, that's in an obvious way, like his classmate. But this, he said, you know, I landed somewhere in the middle, although I think he was on Law Review, but he said that this conscientious objector was brilliant. So, I think that's interesting. And when you say when you go to like, I guess the quote unquote real, Ivy League law schools, that they kind of churn out people like Bill Clinton that say, you know, what's the meaning of the word, you know, is, depends on the meaning of the word is, I don't know if I would necessarily put, the University of Virginia School of Law in that same category.
Yeah, it's it's pretty close.
But it's close. And so I guess that this particular article, which I'm going to send you right now. Let me see. I'm trying to multitask. All right, so Bill Barr. Seems to kind of imply, or it seems to take that whole relationship that they had and bring it forward as sort of an explanation as to how Bill Barr became Attorney General. And because of this whole idea that that Bill Barr apparently was thought to think that Robert Mueller was not a brilliant legal mind, and that he himself is, when it came to the Russia investigation, the article saying that Barr grew convinced that Mueller required guidance. So, and the way they describe it, it seemed like it was much more than just this 18-page memo that Barr apparently submitted to Rod Rosenstein. It seems like he did a lot of courting, quote unquote, because I guess that according to the article, as I just sent it to you, the news reports were hinting that the prosecutors were pursuing a theory that by firing James Comey and publicly attacking the witch hunt, Trump had obstructed justice, and Barr thought that Mueller's quote unquote novel obstruction theory, as he later described it, was a constitutionally dangerous path. So he physically went to the DOJ's headquarters. He met Rod Rosenstein for lunch. And let's see, what did he do? They said they ordered Chinese food in the offices, and discussed a variety of topics, including the Mueller investigation's focus on Comey's firing. And he said Barr told Rosenstein it would be wrong and crippling to criminalize a president's decisions to remove top officials, which were part of his constitutional duties. You know, like what he's probably going to do to Christopher Wray. that's part of his constitutional duties. So, you know, Barr is saying all of this, and I guess that he recalled that, and this is interesting, is that Rosenstein was, quote, sphinx-like in his reaction. So Barr didn't like Rosenstein's reaction. So that's when he followed up with the 18-page with the memo. And they're saying that in this article that Barr was concerned about a politically unaccountable FBI, you know, and the grounding of that would be, you know, the J. Edgar Hoover, who was, you know, head of the FBI for like 40 years, and that he was afraid, Barr was afraid that Trump's case could have a chilling effect on a president's role in law enforcement, which is such bullshit. But anyway, that's when he put his thinking into that long memo, which he not only sent to Rosenstein, but he sent to the head of the Office of Legal Counsel. And that, let's see, I know you will agree that if the DOJ investigation is going to take down a democratically elected president, Barr wrote, it is imperative to the health of our system and to our national cohesion that any claim of wrongdoing is solidly based on evidence of a real crime, not a debatable one. And in the memo, apparently he urged officials not to indulge the fancies.
And you know,
by overly zealous prosecutors, Bob. John Durham, excuse me.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, he's been apparently he just spends his life dodging lightning bolts. That or you know the great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky isn't real, because
a president would have to destroy evidence in order for him to think, according to this article, that would be a specific bad act.
Real crime is kind of a fluid statement. I mean,
real crime? Yeah, R-E-A-L.
Yeah, what's a real crime? I mean, I mean, these are, I'm asking this sincerely. I'm not being a smartass. Is negligent vehicular homicide a real crime? I mean, after all, it doesn't require a specific mens rea. It merely requires negligence.
Exactly.
Knew or should have known.
Oh, but no, it was an accident. Right. Get over it. and I guess that, let's see here, the president has necessarily all-encompassing authority over law enforcement. He alone is the executive branch, Barr wrote, citing a Supreme Court decision. You know, of course, who knows what that Supreme Court decision probably is, that statement's probably taken out of context. While the president has subordinates, the attorney general and DOJ lawyers, oh shit, man, was he auditioning for this job? No question. The president has subordinates, the attorney general and DOJ lawyers who exercise prosecutorial discretion on his behalf. They are merely, quote, his hand, unquote. And I guess that he wanted the message to reach Robert Mueller. So I guess apparently he shared the memo widely among Justice Department alumni, academics, members of Trump's legal team, which included Emmett Flood, you know, who later wrote a big letter saying, you know, that the report was like that of a first or second year law school student. Okay, again, that theme of that Mueller's not intelligent, that kind of thing. Let's see. I think he presented himself to the president as the guy who could get it done, says one former Trump administration DOJ official, and solve the problem that was confronting the president. But Barr has called the suggestion ludicrous that the memo looked like a job application.
No, you can call it what you will, but and, you know the theory of Platonic ideals. I mean,
yeah,
it is what it is. I think Plato was the first one to say that.
And that's
why I said what I said earlier, Darlene. We can get caught up in the moment, and that's all well and good, but let's at least be sober enough to remember that this, in the immortal words of Miss Mayella Ewell, don't come to nothing. This impeachment.
Yeah.
It don't come to nothing. Yeah. And in fact, like Bugs Bunny's finger in the barrel of Elmer Fudd's shotgun, we may be the ones who wind up with powder burns on our faces.
Which is sad, you know, because I think that today, I thought Adam Schiff did a
he was power. He was powerful. He was absolutely powerful.
I looked at him. I'm like, why the fuck isn't he our president? Seriously, I mean, it hit me like, I'm like, he'd be terrific. I think, you know, because he seems like he's so honest and he's measured and he seems like he's good. You know, he's good. And he sat there, you know, he stood there and he talked about, you know, he really brought it into very clear terms. He said it took us 8 months to get a decision from a lower court that, you know, Don McGahn does not have absolute immunity from testifying, that he must acknowledge a subpoena. But that's going to be, contested again. It's going to be appealed, and then we have to have discussions, and then he's got to come in front of us again, and again, it will allow this poor excuse for a president. You know, I'm paraphrasing now. I'm saying my own thing. Yeah. To attempt to steal another election. So I thought he did a really admirable job saying why we have to push it forward quickly, even though, you know, Republicans were complaining that the Mueller investigation was dragging on. And that was moving, in my opinion, at lightning speed. You know, now things are moving too fast for the Republicans.
Well, however they move, they're moving the wrong way. As far as the Republicans are concerned, oh, it's too fast. Oh, it's too slow. And you know what, baby Barr is never going to come in and say this one's moving just right, unless there happens to be a Democrat in the White House. Okay, I'm proud of that exactly. One. I admit, I'm proud of that one. Baby Barr.
That's a good one. That was very good.
Yeah, Papa Bear and Mama Barr and Baby Barr.
Exactly. One bed's too. Off, the other one's too
this
hard.
One's too fast. This one's too slow. Yeah, baby, you know, baby bars in a pit in the basement.
My sense is there's some weird personal issue going on between Barr and Mueller. I think personally, Barr towards Mueller, because my sense has always been he's jealous of Robert Mueller. He's jealous because he's become world famous when he became special counsel. Because and this article seems to say that. It says just 1 year ago, Barr was semi-retired and semi-obscure, practicing law in Washington and living in McLean, Virginia, the deep state's suburban home.
you'll appreciate this. As far Brother Deacon Asa just said a few minutes ago, Barr looks like a fucking shaved Wilfred Brimley wannabe. Who the fuck is he to mentally haze anybody?
Exactly. And I mean, he's so gross. He's gross. He's just gross. His teeth are yellow. He's so gross. His pictures here make him sitting there, pointing a finger and like he's like a fun guy or something. Oh God, I find him.
He's Peppy the goddamn frog come to life.
We have to be careful here. I think you're going to upset Todd because I think he said bullfrogs are cute.
Well, you got it. By the same token, you got a note from Todd. Todd said, "Go, Darlene, preach the truth." And then, as far as Pete Williams interviewing Barr is concerned, he said, "Pete Williams, if you notice, very uncomfortable when the left appears to have a better argument." Well, all those damn millionaires in the for-profit media are. I mean, if you've got the guts. Or the stomach for it, you know, or maybe the anti-nausea medications. Go watch them cackling this morning about Elizabeth Warren. And you know there was that shit-eating Schmidt, going off on her Indian heritage. Well, I know why she claimed Native American heritage. She was trying to game the system. You know, the fact of the matter is, every time it gets brought up, it's like she said something that wasn't true. The fact of the matter is, you know, what is she, 164th? Well, that is, I mean, no, that doesn't enroll you in a tribe, but it is a reflection of your, of the reality of your past. And so it meant that what grandma or whoever was telling them was true.
Right. And she was only repeating what she had heard as a child.
And we gloss over that.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. And the then this morning I'm listening to public radio because I couldn't take my filthy morning habit anymore. And lo and behold, I tune that in, Darlene, and what do I hear? Well, you know, they interviewed some guy who was a real liberal who knew Elizabeth Warren back when she was a pro-corporate Republican.
Oh, God, yeah.
And they went on and on. Oh, Jesus. It's nauseating. And
They're using a lot of liberal arguments against us now. Like in the hearings for the impeachment hearings, like, oh, all of a sudden you Democrats are originalists. Did you hear that one?
Oh yeah. I've heard. And you know what? Oddly enough, when I introduced some of these concepts long before the Republicans said that, hell, maybe it's my fault. Mm-hmm. I said, this is going to sound like I'm an originalist, but I'm not. Because there's a big difference between saying we can't regulate semi-automatic weapons because the framers didn't regulate muzzleloader single shots. There's a big difference between that and saying we actually need to look at the meaning of the words as they were understood by the people who wrote them. Okay, there's no way you can judge the original intent of the framers relative to the Second Amendment because any more than you can judge the original intent of the framers relative to reality television, okay? On the other hand, you can say, what did bribery mean in 1787? And you can find lots, as Professor Carlin pointed out, you can find lots of examples of that. What right, did bribery
yeah.
mean?
The other fellow did too. The fellow there,
Turley.
Oh God, what was his name? Not Turley.
Gerhardt.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember what his name was. He was the one that spoke first. That you know, he actually seemed to confirm a question that I had, and I know that you had, and that Dr. Bill had wondered about too was high crimes and misdemeanors. Does high crimes mean high crimes and high misdemeanors? And according to the constitutional law professor, who was one of the good guys there along with Carlin, said, yeah, it's high crimes and high misdemeanors. You know, that there was this, that they had very specific meanings.
And one of the other things that I think would have been fun had it been put to Turley, because I heard this earlier in the day, too. Oh, Jesus, or maybe it was yesterday. Oh, Jesus, I heard them say that they can just impeach him again and again and again. Oh, shit, how's it do? God damn it. And so, you know, when Turley said, you're doing it wrong, you're going too fast, you don't have finality on the court orders, I wish, because I didn't, I mean, I watched almost the whole thing, and I didn't hear any of the Democrats ask him, so what you're saying, Johnny, is if we wait and we get final orders from the Supreme Court that says he is wrong, 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 that he has to answer the subpoenas, we will have finality on that. And so we can go ahead and impeach him then, and you'll come back and you'll tell us that impeaching him is the right thing to do. Because I want you on record with that, Jonathan Turley. You're telling us if we do it the way you're telling us to do it, that you'll be supportive of impeaching this monstrosity. Is that where we are? Because that was a missed opportunity of monumental proportions, Darlene.
Well, there are a lot of missed opportunities, and maybe we're being hard on these on the Democratic committee members because they're in flux. It's right there, happening in real time, and you know it's like I can sit here, sort of. What is it? Sunday morning.
You know what? There are No. I'm sorry. I can't go there. There are cross examinations that take place in real time by their thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, every day in these United States, and shitty little lawyers with shitty little JDs from shitty little state schools have been trained to have their pink little ears perk up when they get handed something like Jonathan Turley handed. But no, I do. I cut them some slack. And certainly, you know, there's lots of really, really good lawyers in there. But Jesus Christ, that one was hanging above the rim, and it was just waiting for LeBron to come home and just and hang on the rim for about 15 minutes after he did. Mr. Turley, I just want to make sure. You want to? I tell you what. After we win all these cases, will you just like you don't have to put it in ink, but open your schedule and like 3-4 months from now, would you just bracket a couple of weeks and you can use pencil and say coming back to tell House to impeach Trump now? Can you do that for us, Johnny? He would have had a goddamn baby on the spot, and I would have, oh, that had been a ticket to have. And just before we ring off and before we run out of time, one of the other stories that kind of grabbed me today is that Pete Buttigieg has now released a partial list of his clients from his days working for the vaunted and secretive McKinsey Consulting. Did you see this?
I caught a headline on that he had. Go ahead. I saw something briefly, but I didn't.
Well, he's been taking a lot of shit, and you know, people on our side have been calling him Wall Street Pete, and there's a lot not to like about him. But I'll vote for him if he's the goddamn nominee. Okay. Well, let's be. You know, I think we're all in that same place. Mm-hmm. But McKinsey had been telling him, "No, goddamn it, you signed an NDA. You can never get out of that." And it finally dawned on McKinsey that maybe that was not the best position for them to take. And so they gave him permission to release his client list, but not go into depth about topicality. So his client list includes Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, a Canadian supermarket chain called Loblaws, the electronics chain Best Buy. This is a weird one. The National Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. I'm generally well inclined toward them. He did consulting work for the EPA, for the Department of Energy, for the U.S. Postal Service, and for the DOD. Now, it's kind of interesting that the little bit of detail that we do get says that, for instance, he didn't do anything relating to premiums or anything like that with Blue Cross. He was working on something entirely different. What kind of got me is that he's been getting hammered over this, and he has learned, Darlene, and the ability to learn is important. He has learned the lesson of 2016. It's almost like somebody on his staff has gone back and said, "What was that Kincaid guy saying?" Because if you recall, way, way, way back in 2016, when Hillary was getting just bludgeoned every day, "Oh, goddamn that goddamn Hillary. Oh, she gave speeches to Goldman Sachs. Goddamn." You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, release it. And
I said, release the damn things now. Let everybody hear her telling the little Goldman Sachs bankers in the room that they all shit ice cream. And then we can move on. But instead, she decided to get her back up. And oh no, goddamn it! And this was actually more complicated because McKinsey had greater rights in this. And apparently, he leaned in on him and said, "Listen, I'm running for fucking president here. You can't pull this shit on me. I got to release a client list." Mm-hmm. And so
put it in the sunlight.
Yeah, put it and lo and behold, we're going to find out that somewhere along the way he told the people at Blue Cross Blue Shield that they shit ice cream. Right. And that's okay. And I actually feel a little bit better about it because I don't think NRDC would have brought him aboard if he was, you know, total corporate scum. He made like $73,000 in money in working for McKinsey, and What was it?
What was he consulting? What specifically was he consulting on? Like, what was he a consultant?
Well, I mean, there's some reference in here. Let me find it here. Just a sec. Let's see. His stint with EPA and the Energy Department included researching ways to attack climate change through energy efficiency. He worked on employment and entrepreneurship in Iraq and Afghanistan. He looked for ways for the Postal Service to develop new streams of revenue.
Seems innocuous.
He looked at overhead expenditures like rent, utilities, and company travel for Blue Cross Blue Shield.
So it's a fairly safe release of information, I think.
Yeah.
Based on what you're reading.
But what's more important to me is it shows that he knows a little bit about crisis management because his campaign was in crisis.
He's never really recovered from the I don't think he's really recovered. I don't know if I'm on board. I don't even know how to even tell my gay and lesbian friends that I think he's slippery.
well, the funny thing is, because, you know, really, you're gay and lesbian.
From what happened,
your gay and lesbian friends are all in on him because, oddly enough,
the ones that I've talked to like him. Yeah,
here the LGBTQ members here at the Horn probably are harder on him than.
I agree.
Yeah,
they're way ahead of him. Exactly. But he's not. I don't think he's really recovered from the police shooting. And the horrible things that he said to African Americans that were talking to him. One woman that was upset, and he said something like, "Well, I'm not asking for your vote," or something like that. It was really bad.
Yeah.
It was bad. I don't think he's really recovered from that. But he just, to me, he's slippery. That said, if he becomes a Democratic nominee, I will vote.
He gets
for
my
him.
Vote. I mean, look, I'm.
He gets my vote.
If he wins the nomination, I've already promised my vote to a guy who's only 16 years younger than than Jimmy Carter.
I know. And I will gag. I will absolutely gag if I have to vote for.
I mean, I'm
Biden.
Sorry. It just.
I just think he's pathetic. I'm sorry.
Him you calling know,
I'm
the.
Leaning towards Bernie or, you know.
Him calling that dude fat. And telling him he wanted to go fight in the parking lot. And then Grandpa Joe calling a guy a damn liar. You're a damn liar, man. And stop with the jacks and the mans and the off.
Come on, man. Yeah, exactly. That's ridiculous. Just to jump back really quick to Bill Barr in this article, this thing here about, I guess, when he got in front of... it was the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, and I don't know if he was in front of the Federalist Society. He was addressing the annual conference of the Federalist Society, and this guy, he's got a way of, the things he says in these speeches. What he said about a police, about gun violence and police officers, better respect your police officers, or you're going to lose. You know, he comes out with these things that are highly inflammatory. But he said, the grammar school civics class version of our revolution is that it was a rebellion against monarchical tyranny, and that in framing our Constitution, one of the preoccupations, the main preoccupation of the founders, was to keep the executive weak, Barr told the audience. That this is misguided. Instead, Barr advocates for what is known as a unitary executive.
Oh, the unitarian executive. Fuck. Yeah.
This is a really, I encourage people to look at this pretty damn good article.
I'm looking forward to reading it.
Yeah. And he said one of the more amusing aspects of modern progressive polemic is their breathless attacks. And I think we heard him. I think this was thrown out there on the media, on the unitary executive theory, Barr said. He paused for effect, waved his arms, and shouted ghoulishly, blah. So So he recounted his own confirmation hearing in which Democratic senators pressed him to explain his muscular philosophy. This is not new, and it's not a theory, Barr said. If anything, he argued the president's rightful power had been stolen. A view shaped by his personal history, Barr started his career as a CIA analyst in 1973 in the midst of Watergate.
Wow.
At the time, the agency was besieged by revelations of its misdeeds, congressional investigations, political battles, overregulation of intelligence activities. I don't necessarily see Barr as brilliant. I think he's devious and dastardly. So I'm not prepared to say he's brilliant. But, you know, I'm looking at this stuff. It's like, wow, there's a lot here, especially they start off as a CIA analyst in 1973. And don't forget, there was one person that stumped him, and that was the woman, you know, Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
When she asked him that question, you know, and he was like, give me a fucking break. You could even see Cory Booker was laughing when, you know, Barr's like, well, I'm hung up on the word, I can't remember what the word was.
I'm hung up on what the meaning of is.
Yeah, what the meaning of is, but where she was saying, has he suggested? I think it's has Trump suggested.
Yeah, I'm hung up on the meaning of the word suggest.
So anyway, it's good. This is a pretty interesting article. I'm glad I had a chance to talk to you about it. I'm going to do much more of a deep dive into it. But enjoy. And I know you need to, I keep forgetting because you're starting early that you need to sign off. So, but I just wanted to share that.
No, I'm glad you did. It's always a great conversation.
I'm stunned about well, likewise. And I'm stunned about his role in Whitewater. He unearthed that and brought it to Washington.
And the fact that he took now I'm stunned by the fact that he took a job as a young CIA analyst at a time, Watergate, when the CIA was under deep scrutiny for all of its dirty business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's more.
You know, that's before the Church Committee and all of that stuff.
You know, and just his seeming hatred of the FBI. What the fuck is going on there, too? You know. You know, because it's like no matter what, and Horowitz seems like he cuts to the chase. I mean, Horowitz seems fairly.
I know this sounds paranoid.
And the stuff that he.
I know this sounds paranoid, Darlene, and I know it sounds all too convenient, but all I can say every time we find ourselves going, why? Because the Russians have the RNC fucking server.
You got it. And again, that's the other thing they're not bringing up. It's like, oh my God, why didn't anyone bring that up to Mueller and say, look, in your indictment of the, 12, 13 Russians, one or two lines, you said the RNC server was also hacked. There's like one line or maybe one sentence, maybe two sentences was devoted to that. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't
and then see what's important. What's important.
The report.
What's important about that is that, you know, you can say, yeah, they, the only reason that we know what was in the DNC hack is that they released it. You cannot say with any degree of certainty, surety or confidence that they didn't get anything from the RNC, because the only people who have said that is Trump. He's,
well, you know, they hacked the RNC too, but they did a better job, so they didn't get anything.
Oh, really? Think about that. Hey, Darlene, I do have to, I got to get out of here, but it's been a delightful conversation. I hope the weather holds for you. Be careful out there.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's Darlene calling from Connecticut, and we are at the end of the program. So I will thank you all very kindly for spending your precious finite time engaging in the program. I'll thank each and every one of you who is a subscriber or an a la carte contributor. Thank you so very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.